You're listening to Red Setter, your guide to digital cinema, filmmaking, and cutting-edge imaging.
Hello and welcome to this week's Red Setter. I'm Mike Seymour.
I'm Jason Wingrove. Hey, Mike.
Hey, man, how are you?
I'm very well.
Okay, so we're going to get straight into the news this week, because last week we didn't get straight into the news, and people will comment that they'd like us to be slightly more structured. But I think the fun stuff this week is in the news. But before we do that, I do want to just flag what's coming up later in the show, because you've done an absolutely terrific interview. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yes. As we spoke about last episode, had a chat with Brooke Willard, who's just fantastic. He was a mine of information, and as I sort of said, he's really sort of, well, I mean, it almost seems a bit too strong to say he's kind of pioneered the whole concept of being a DT, but maybe that's possibly true. He's certainly very vocal and very influential on the whole Red User Forum. He's a moderator on the forum and is very much a part of the whole movement of getting the whole DT or DIT sort of getting it running right. And so there's a lot to learn. He's got some fantastic things to say about pitfalls and, you know, some of the golden rules, really, I suppose, of avoiding screw-ups.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that interview. And his credits actually include such amazing TV series as ER and Southland, and that's coming up later in the show. But let's kick off the show now with news.
Yeah, well, obviously, one of the big news, it's not red news, but hey, we'll go with whatever is news. And
we actually do have some red news, but yes,
we do definitely have some red news. But the first most pressing one is the Canon 7D, which was sort of long been rumoured, and a lot of specs have been around, but theoretically, obviously, now it's actually out in the open, we know what to expect. Not full frame sensor, which I was hoping for, but it is APS-C sensor. 18 megapixel stills up to 8 frames a second, which in itself is pretty impressive. But obviously the main thing that's attracting our attention is the fact that it is finally cracking not only the 24 and 25 frames per second point that we've been trying to sort of, you know, get Canon to address for a long time, also doing 50 and 60 frames a second, which is just amazing. Not at 1080p, which it does at 24 and 25 and 30 frames a second, but at least at 720p, which in itself is pretty amazing. I think, you know, as we've talked about before, it's pretty easy to get sort of spoilt nowadays about what to expect and what these cameras can do. It's a goddamn stills camera for a start. Come on, let's, you know, cut it some slack. To do 720p at 50 or 60 frames a second, and almost the most important and most amazing sort of point of the whole thing is the fact that the body is $1,700. I just think it is outstanding. And when you think about the fact that essentially the APS-C size sensor is within a mil or two of a Red One sensor size, it's, you know, we should be pretty happy.
I think that's a really important point that you're making there. A number of people in the discussion about the cameras have commented that it's not full sensor. And, of course, that's true. And it isn't a full size as is, say, the 5D Mark II. But this sensor is not a tiny little sensor. The sensor the 7D has, the APS-S-C, is in fact, as you say, about the same size as, pretty close to actually full frame 35mm. Pretty close to super 35
yes,
in frame
exactly.
size.
The Red One, the Mysterium, is 24.4 by 13.7 mils, and a 7D, or essentially the APS-C format, is 22.3 by 14.9, so slightly wider but not quite as tall, so, you know, near enough, essentially as near as damn it in terms of you know, what you're going to achieve with depth of field, and you know, you're going to achieve the same results with this, you know, obviously, albeit there's, you know, there's all of the other sort of caveats that there's, you know, it's compression, and, you know, there's no Red RAW, it's all very, you know, it is you know, there's compression in there. But
well, there is definitely compression there because it's H.264. But I don't think, I mean, this is a really pivotal question. I don't think it's a fairly, I don't know. Is it a valid thing to compare this to a Red One or a Scarlett? Do you feel that is something that should be compared, or are we doing apples to oranges?
Oh, look, I think it's great stopgap technology. I think that we really start to see this DSMC stuff come into play and physically have these things in our hands, and because at the moment it still really feels like a stills camera that has a movie mode. You know, there's so many little ergonomic, for me anyway, ergonomic sort of gotchas, and you know, it's still sort of kind of kludgy and clunky the way you sort of have to work it. I'm still seeing it as a fantastic bonus feature, and I've shot a couple of commercials with it already, and it's great, and it gets you out of a hole, and you can get a great look for you know, with a very simple piece of kit that you can run, you know, a set of one, a crew of one essentially. But it shouldn't really be comparing it to Red One. It's not, you know, it's completely different object. This is not a motion picture camera. This is a stills camera that has a fantastic movie mode.
Look, I'll admit, at this price, $16.99, I bought one within about 2 minutes of it going up on Amazon, and I noticed actually the next day Amazon moved it from going to be a pre-order to actually being out of stock, which was interesting.
Right.
It's not shipping until the end of the month. But the reason I bought it is I think it'll be a really good camera for doing interviews. If I'm going to have an interview,
yeah,
I'm not worried about camera shake and stuff and the problem of the physicality of it. I'm really not that actually worried about a whole bunch of things. I can just set up on a nice lens, frame up nicely, light it nicely, and then with a stereo input coming into the camera, just record an interview with a couple of wireless mics, and that's an easy camera to carry around. The second thing I'm interested in using it for is those occasions where if I was to pull out a more professional-looking video camera, I'd be thrown out.
Yes.
As we covered in the course we did on, or am doing at the moment on FXPHD on digital cinematography, we filmed in Japan where we just couldn't have filmed had we had even a P2 camera.
While make use of the sort of stealth factor of SLRs, while it still lasts and while before people and security guards really realise and get the idea that these things can do motion picture as well.
But I mean, you know, I can do motion picture, as it were, on my iPhone.
That's true. That's
so,
true.
You know,
that's
I just don't see how... I don't think that the world's going to suddenly go, oh, you can't use DSLRs. But, so I just threw that in for you, Jason.
Very good.
No, but I don't think the world's going to say that you can't use an SLR. They're going to say, you know what, we just give up, because it's going to be too hard to police not having a phone, not having any kind of camera, because almost anything can record video. The fact that it records 24p makes no difference to a security guard.
Yeah. Well, can I pick your brains about it for a minute, because, I mean, you're talking about shooting sound with it, right, or shooting sync sound with it.
Yep.
The 24 frames per second isn't exactly 24 frames. Neither is the 25. It's 24.99976 or whatever. It's 23.976.
Yep.
It's not 30 frames. It's 29.997. What does that really mean to... I mean, is that...
That's just the standard for... So when you say 24p, it's pretty much interchangeable with 23.9, because the way that the world works is for these things to be compatible when you go from 24 to 30... You use 3.2 pull down and stuff. And so in the world of HD production, you're never actually normally shooting 24p, strictly speaking. Mm-hmm. A film camera will run at 24 frames a second.
Absolutely, exactly. So if you tell your sound guy to run 24, his solid state audio recording system is probably going to run at hard on 24.
Well, it depends what you're running on the camera, but don't forget also a minute of sound is a minute of film. The time-wise are identical, yeah?
Yeah.
But yes, in terms of time code, you're going to pick whatever time code you're running with.
If you chuck a clip in from an audio file from a sound recordist who you're told to run at 25 frames and your camera's running at 24.997 or something and you're recording a five-minute interview,
I don't know why the camera won't run at 25, and I've not heard that it won't run at 25. Are you saying that it won't run at 25?
I thought the actual specs were...
You're not talking about 30 now. You mean 25?
Yeah, I thought 20... I could be wrong about the 25.
I think 24 doesn't run 24 at exactly 24, and 30 doesn't run at exactly 30, because they're both designed to work with American televisions, which have drop frame and not exactly increments. But 25 is 25, because there's absolutely no reason not to be, because PAL is actually 25.
Right, okay.
NTSC is not actually 30 frames a second. Having said that, we're also used to that in post-production, that we interchangeably use 24 and 23.98. It's pretty much the same thing.
Right.
Okay. The thing about...
It's a non-issue.
It's a non-issue, yeah, no, definitely. But the thing that is a big difference is the fact that you've moved from 30 to 24, because there is no simple, easy, don't worry about it way to move from vision at 30 frames a second to vision at 24 frames a second without producing serious artifacts. But I was going to say the thing that I'm kind of bummed about with this discussion about this camera is I don't have a clear thing in my own head in answer to this very simple question. If tomorrow the 5D Mark II came out with a 24p option, would I cancel the 7D option and go to the 5D Mark II, or would I stay with the 7D? And I actually asked that on the Twitters of my peeps, and there was a pretty much split diff. It was like, well, we'd prefer to have the full frame sensor that you would get from having a 24p upgrade that obviously doesn't exist versus, to the 5D Mark II.
Versus having the option of 60 frames a second at 720p.
Yes.
720p is fantastic. It's still an amazing...
It isn't, it isn't. I'm going to say... Well,
most of the digital broadcasting, you know, most of the... On HD, you know, direct, you know, DVB or whatever, digital broadcast is, you know, sort of half HD. It's 720p, isn't it?
Yeah, the thing is, though, that it's an originating problem. See, we love the RED 1 for shooting at 4K for use at 2K because that oversampling is terrific. Yeah. If the way they get to 720p is just throwing lines away, then you stand the risk at 720p of having a signal that isn't as well anti-aliased as a signal that was coming from a down-res, properly matrixed signal from a high-resolution camera. So if you're shooting film for 720p on air, if you're shooting HD for 720p on air and you down-res from the 1920x1080, you would get a better signal. Now, is the 720 60 frames going to be useful? You know, bet your bottom dollar it will. But that price difference is almost, it's like $900. You'd be paying, more than that, actually, you're paying $1,200. Because the difference between $1,700 and about $2,900 for...
US, probably.
Yeah, for the full frame. As you already pointed out, the depth of field on the... because that's the main thing we're after, right? Depth of field with a full-frame sensor.
It's staggeringly different.
It is staggeringly different, but if you were to invest that extra $1,400, whatever it is, that you have difference in a faster lens, wouldn't you just make it back?
Well, I guess...
Yeah, 1.2 50 mil is going to look pretty good compared to a 2.8.
True,
when you guys spend all this extra money on a camera body and you can't afford any good lenses, then I say you're worse off.
I think, but you can still put those really far. You can put a 1.3 lens on a full frame.
Are you going to get like an eyelash in focus and an eyeball out of focus?
That's fantastic.
Oh, God, you're just a junkie. Aren't you?
It's fantastic, fantastic. But... I mean, what there is definitely, theoretically, there's a change to the data rates between these two cameras. Apparently, one is maybe a little under 5 megabits, I can't find out is whether it's megabytes or megabits per second. But the 7D has a slightly higher data rate.
Would you like me to explain?
Well, the other thing, obviously, being the smaller sensor, is that
you will... geeky numbers. That's my department.
Please do. While you're investigating that, the other thing is, obviously, and what everyone has been shoehorning onto the 5D in the meantime has been, you know, putting Panavision lenses and other mounts and Zeiss standards and master primes and putting these on the 5D and shooting with them. And obviously, one of the restrictions of that has been that... if you're putting film zooms on, obviously, just with the fact that they are designed all built around, you know, a smaller piece of film, 35mm motion picture, you have to generally push into about 30mm. You can't use the wider lenses on that. So obviously, with the 7D, you are going to be able to put on any, you know, once you've got the right mount or mount adapter, you're going to be able to put on any cine lens. You're going to have a much wider range of other glass to use.
Yes, to a point. The only reason I'm going to stop you there is that there's a big difference between putting a PV mount on this 7D and putting a PL mount on this. And the reason is the PL mount's going to be 52 millimeters, and on some lenses that's going to actually play with the reflex action of the SLR.
Yeah.
And when you put a PV mount on, PV mount's what, 2.25 so... inch, so it's basically about an extra 10 mil of depth that you get. So the PV mount lenses will not interfere with the mirror in the SLR the way that a PL mount could. So, yes, I know what you're saying, and I think it's completely valid that you could stick a lens on and you wouldn't have to worry about it shooting off the sensor the way that you do with the 5D. But that being said, I guess I would totally expect people to put PV mounts on these suckers, and I would think that would be a great thing to do.
I mean, it's restricted, obviously, because, PV mount Most of the Panavision glass in the world is a rental only, and the other half of it is probably fairly rare and on a show. One of the other questions we're yet to find out, obviously, and when you get yours, you'll be able to tell us, Mike, is at the 720p mode, is it, I'm wondering, is it just like, you know, down-resing, or is it going to be a sensor crop?
Yeah, that's the other, yeah, I was alluding to that earlier, I never got back to that point, yeah, which is exactly, is how do you get to the 720p?
Would it be like swapping to 3K on the red one, you know, are we going to punch in? That happening. I'm imagining when it goes to 7, it's just going to be down-resing, and we're going to be throwing away information,
I think,
I guess.
You're right. I think they'll just throw away more lines, and the field of view won't change. But as you say, we don't know. Let me answer your other question, because it's a nice geeky one, and I can get my teeth around it.
The megabytes.
Yeah, so it's 5.5 megabytes a second,
right, megabytes,
which translates into about 44 megabits a second, because obviously there are 8 bits to a byte in simple maths. So if you look at digital formats, and I posted this, as you mentioned this the other day on a podcast, I posted this in my 140 Twitter feed and immediately got called out by Stu over it, which I think was a bit unfair because I really only had 140 characters to express this in. But a DVC Pro HD is 100 megabits a second.
Yep.
And so that would be more, of course, than the 7D. Now, that being said, DVC Pro HD is not as good a compression algorithm as H.264. So you're actually getting kind of a better bang for your buck,
right,
bang for your bit, out of a 7D. DVC Pro 50 is, of course, 50. That's why they call it that. HDV, and for that matter, something like off-air
Blu-ray.
HD. Down at 25, and in the case of Blu-ray, it's like 10 or 12 megabits a second. Now, the reason that that is so astonishingly low is the same reason that Red Ray will be so astonishingly low, which is you can get really low on anything that you don't expect to edit and color grade. So comparing it to an off-air HD format is not really a valid comparison. But by way of comparison, an R3D file is up at, to use the same maths, 288 megabits a second on RC36,
right,
and would be considerably higher if you were to go above RC36.
Oh, nice segue, Mike. Oh, speaking of segues, no, I won't go there again. Red Code 42 is going to be here in about a month. Essentially, there'll be no charge for the upgrade. It'll be a simple firmware upgrade, and then you'll have the option of Red Code 42. Now, the only gotcha so far that I can find is that you won't be able to record RC42 on existing 8 gig cards, which is, you know, no real biggie, unless of course that's all you have. But I presume you just bump down to a lower red code for those cards. Now, everything else, of course, is compatible 16 gig cards and red drives and the RAM drives. Now, with that firmware comes something that is confusing me a little bit, is that I believe you have the option of bumping up to 4.5K.
I know. I think this has got really missed in the news cycles because of the 7D. But I'm like, what the?
Which is now my...
A no-cost upgrade, I might add.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the red one has always had a 4.5K sensor, but that extra 0.5 of a K all the way around has been used primarily as what they call look-around, you know, essentially being able to see the mic boom coming in from shot or, you know, the actor just out of frame before they actually physically get recorded to the R3D. So essentially it's, you know, like an optical viewfinder. You get to see outside the exposed frame area. Essentially, that, you know, that's look around, and that's what that extra extra 0.5 of a K was essentially thrown away. Now, essentially, the firmware upgrade will let you use that and get that slightly wider field of view. Obviously, I'm guessing, and I'm yet to sort of get this confirmed, that you do lose the look around functionality, which is a nice thing, but I guess it depends what kind of stuff you're shooting. So, we're yet to find that out, but if you know, give us a buzz. But that will be a reasonable...
If you work at Red and you want to leak through
this
show,
at Red and you want to tell
feel
us some,
free.
You know, yeah, exactly.
But
let
this
us know.
This is pretty astounding because the jump in the RC alone is worth having. I mean, we're talking about, by my previous maths, jumping up to 336 megabits a second, which is about a 20% jump. 20% jump in the amount of data that's being recorded per second. This is a non-trivial amount of additional data.
So we should be really excited about this. I'm not going, wow.
Well, no, I am. I'm really, like, chuffed because one of the things that I thought we were going to see in Scarlet and Epic is a jump up to 100, RC100.
Yeah, yeah.
I was thinking, wow, big jump between 36 and 100. The fact that they have – I had no idea this was even coming, that they were going to get this extra bandwidth. And I always thought sensor. It was a limitation of the back plane inside the camera, that the camera couldn't get the data processed fast enough out to anything, yet alone you know, the recording device not being able to keep up.
Yeah, so to be able to have a bigger sensor, more information, and have less compression and record it to, you know, almost exactly the same pieces of equipment without any real gotchas. What we yet to find out is what will be the limitations of this red code. If you go to 42, is it going to limit you? You know, I mean, I guess now if you want to do something like 50 frames a second, you've got to go to 3K, or you have
to. Do you reckon that
what will be your limitations then? With a higher data rate, are you going to be limited if you want to go to, if you want to overcrank?
If you did the math, theoretically, this would let you at RC42 should let you go to a higher frame rate because you've now got a bigger pipe, and so you can shove more frames down the pipe.
Right.
Go down to 2K, and if you're shoving your frames down a 36 megabyte a second pipe, you can only shove so many down. Make the pipe a bit bigger out to 42 megabytes a second, and you could shove even more frames. I don't know. That's true.
So then theoretically, with the newer firmware, you may be able to get higher frame rates. With
there may be some other limiting factor, but yeah, absolutely.
Because at the moment, what's the highest one? Is it 32?
Well, you're 120 frames on 2K, is that what you mean?
No. What's the highest? Is it RC36? What's the highest red code at the moment?
So RC36.
36, and then you go down to 28. Yeah, so theoretically, to do any real sort of overcranking, you have to bump down to RC28 or change your sensor. So it would be interesting to know, once this comes out, what will be, you know, what's the new rules as to what you can get away with? The leap of logic I'm quite not getting my head around is how, with more data coming through, being processed by the same processor and the same camera, how that will possibly let you then overcrank more without having to change anything.
Well, it shouldn't do RC42. It can do RC42. It can do a higher rate of processing data. And so upping the frame rate is just, like, you know, in, like, you up the frame rate, it's the equivalent of just upping the data rate. You hit a limit, and the limit is normally RC36's limit. Now, it's not quite as simple as that, because the whole point of the RC, I'm sort of simplifying it, but yeah, theoretically, if you can cope with a higher data rate. But I mean, look, I'm completely speculating.
Okay.
Somebody at Red right now is doubled over on the floor, feet in the air, laughing his head off, going, "You idiot." But it may not happen, but it would not surprise me if it did happen. It may not happen, of course.
Okay. So, yes, again, you get some free upgrades on your camera that you bought over heading into 2 years. So, well done, Red.
Okay. Also, in similar Red news, we've known for a while that Red has gone off hyping itself until it had something more to show, but it sounds like they in fact have something more to show.
Yeah, at IBC, looks like Jared and Jim will be filling in for Ted, who now can't attend IBC, but what they will be bringing with them is the latest Epic prototype, and will be chained to Jared's wrist and be obviously be under tight security. So sounds like they'll be bringing a prototype that has yet to be seen.
Jared's a pretty decent guy. I don't think you're going to take him.
Yeah. And someone did say, well, what stage is the prototype at? And basically Jim said, the prototype will be at a stage that makes you wish you had one. So
it was IBC, 2 years ago, where they showed the footage of the chicks drinking the milk a retro petrol station-y kind of set, and the shots of the car, the very sort of arty studio shots in the tent. I remember because John Montgomery, my business partner, desperately tried to get in and had to wait a whole loop to get around to seeing some more footage. But this is terrific news. I mean, this is great news. It backs up what we were talking about last week, which is the idea of shipping a Scarlet, first Scarlet, around the November timeframe.
Yes, well done. Good scoop, Mike. And IBC will be definitely be something to attend to if you can get there. And obviously there will be another Red Reel showing there, which no doubt for those who can't attend eventually after the event, hopefully they'll post that for us to look at, as they did with the NAB reel.
Now, just as we're going to air, I've heard that there's a new 4/5, which is about the size of the 7D Olympus video compatible camera coming out, but I have no details on it. So
4/5.
I think the nickname for that size of the sensor that they have in the 7D is a 4/5.
Oh, okay, right.
I could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll check out that, and if that is true, and
5/5 being full frame.
5/5 being full frame.
Right.
I believe, obviously, Sony came out with a full frame sensor camera that did not record HD video. So we're not discussing that. But if this Olympus does, in fact, record video, which would be interesting, and certainly open it up, then one can only imagine it's a matter of time before Nikon re-enters the fray with a full HD.
Well, as I said to you, Mike, I'm cameraless at the moment and holding off. I haven't leapt at the 7D as you have, which is a fantastic decision. Congratulations. You may have done it 5 minutes after they announced it. You're probably 5,000th in line for your camera. Who knows?
I'm sure I am 5,000th in line. As we said, there were 10,000 5D Mark IIs sold in Australia alone at that show. We went to the photography show.
But part of me waiting is just wanting to see the next move, I guess, which is Nikon's reworking of the Nikon 700, which has been D700, which has been highly acclaimed as it is, and has always and is at the moment a full frame camera. So what strongly rumored to be adding a video mode to its the reworking of it, the 3D700S. So that's I'm holding out for that. I think I'm going to be one of those people. I'm just going to be holding out and holding out and just never have anything. Just waiting for the next thing.
I know we don't go for a clean tag, so I'll happily say fuck that. I'm getting a camera.
But I think even the 2/3-inch Scarlett is probably going to, outgun a lot of these cameras, even though it's going to have the smaller sensor.
I'm completely going to buy a Scarlett.
No, very little compression and the ability to go 120, 180 frames per second. Its ability to go from a small, hold it in your hand camera to something that you can stack on a whole bunch of stuff and put it on a tripod and be, proud to sort of, shoot on set with.
If you're working in a production environment and you already have an investment in Canon lenses, which you don't in this particular case, $1,600, $1,700 is completely
absolutely
production. I mean, how much do you say you spent on film on one day on that ad?
It's true.
Like 17 grand or something.
Yes, it was pretty much a red one's worth of
$1,700 is totally inside what a production can afford.
Yeah. Well, for me, there's the cameras that I rent and there's the camera that I want to buy, and they come out of two different budgets,
okay.
One of which I pay for, the other one I don't, okay. I suppose, in a way. But I don't mean to necessarily fly the red flag, so to speak, but I still think that in November or so, when we see, I still think that the 2/3-inch Scarlett that we think we're going to get and the camera, I think what Red's told us they're going to do and what we're actually going to see are going to be two different things. There's been too much water under the bridge with all of this and the 7D and the 5D Mark II and 700D700S, all this stuff that's coming. There's just too much water under the bridge for Red themselves have said we're not, guaranteed to change, so...
Look, the thing that brought me to Red in the first place was Graham Natras's work with the R3D files, and that hasn't changed. It's H.264 is not setting my afterburners alight the way that a really good grading session with R3D does.
Absolutely.
Hey, just a quick other bit of Red trivia while we're at it. There are some new Red user T-shirts, is that right?
Trivia
it is. They are saying Red user, not Red crack, right?
It's Red. They should say Red Crack. There's landmine.tv selling Red user shirts. They actually look pretty good. There's green, red, and grey for $15. Oh, they look pretty good if you want to fly the flag for Red Crack.
Slightly less trivial is there's a new beta of Red Rocket Cine?
Rocket Cine X and the Red Rocket. I guess it's the firmware for the card. Perhaps there's a Red Rocket mm-hmm. installer.
Yep.
There is a list a mile wide for the Rocket Cine X changes. So obviously this is a piece of software that only at the moment works and only has functionality with it will only launch if you have a Red Rocket card installed, right, Mark?
One of the really big advantages that this list conveniently sort of doesn't flag.
I'm glazing
is,
over.
Yeah, so there's a real bug in the current release where it'll flash frame a frame as if you've knocked the green and the red channels out, or right. like almost like a blue frame of not totally blue, but you know what I mean. Like
randomly in the middle of a clip or something.
Yeah, exactly. And that was just a bug. And this is one of the things that this has been. We've been looking at this and we like it. So yes.
Right, okay. Well, there is a list a mile wide of people. So, as obviously, a lot of these have come from users and from people.
There were quite a few early
card owners
that were in the first version, yeah. But that's fair enough. I mean, you know.
Excellent.
It was a beta. Hey, I'm really keen to get to your interview. Do you want to do that next or the gear? Because you've found an amazing piece of gear.
I will do... Well, I mean, the... Let's go to the interview. We'll come back because I've got a great piece of gear after the interview. The interview is definitely worth listening to.
Oh yeah, totally. It's really good.
It is longish, but it's definitely worth every moment. It's I must really thank Brooke for taking time to have a chat. It's it was really really great. The mine of information. About really how not to screw up the whole DIT thing. How ER came to shoot. Totally switch cameras that it shot for 15 years on film. How did swap? How they came about switching to Red for the last sort of 6 or 7 episodes, and plenty more. So I'll let Brooke speak for himself. I'm speaking to Brooke Willard, a huge presence in the Red community, a moderator on Red User, and one of the most vocal contributors to the Red Arena. Hey, Brooke, thanks for taking the time.
How's it going?
So. In a nutshell, give me the Brooke Willard story.
The Brooke Willard story, how I got into DIT, man. I guess how I came across Red was, probably about a year before it came out. A friend of mine mentioned that he had heard about this great new camera coming out on the internet, and that was back when Red had, just first bought their website. And it seemed like a really great thing. It was I was always a film guy. I had been doing a couple of years of camera assisting, and I did a couple of years of grip and electric before that. And I had, I had been doing a bunch of non-union features and such, and I had worked in a post house prior to that, so I had a bunch of working knowledge on the subject, but I never really liked HD. It wasn't enough for me. It wasn't enough resolution, and I didn't like the fact, that I had to run a tether to the camera, and there were all these different lenses, and it was a huge ordeal. So the Red seemed great. It was, it was a film size sensor. I could use my favorite film lenses. I could, run up to the top of the hill for that sunset shot and not worrying about towing a refrigerator full of hard drives behind me. So I just started following it and learning what there was to learn. As, any technology or any bits of info that I didn't know back then, I would just teach myself. And by the time, the camera was getting ready to ship, I was, Jim and Jared and the guys over at Red had kind of gotten in touch with me, and I had I had freelance for them working at the trade show and had all this hands-on time with the camera. And it was quite nice. Actually, on the day that the first Red One shipped, must have been 6 or 7 cameras. About a quarter of the cameras that existed in the world at that time went straight from Red's headquarters to a stage that I had rented for that day. And we were able to do, the first ever test as a whole lot of us were just playing with these cameras that we had been wishing to get our hands on for years.
Fantastic.
And it's really just been that from then on out. It's been essentially nothing but DITing for the last, it's been 2 years now since the cameras come out. And in that time, it's gone from, obviously something quite small that people had heard about, but didn't really have as much faith into, something that is, I'm calling you from a prep for an NBC TV show second season, and there you go. So it has come a long way in these 2 years.
Well, you have done some cream red jobs. Take us through your on-set role, I guess, because on a big show, it really is much more than just backing up the drives at lunchtime.
Yeah, absolutely. It's there's actually a lot of responsibility, and it's a very creative position, which is nice. The generic duty is, know the camera, be able to fix it if it breaks, and make sure the footage gets backed up. And that's kind of the simple approach to it. But on larger shows, it goes well beyond that. So on, ER would be a good example. when ER switched, you know, from film to Red after 15 years. I had worked with the producers on a previous project. The main responsibility on that show was get everybody used to this, get everybody used to the idea of Red, have the answers, have the experience where others didn't, and make it look like ER. You know, we had this benchmark that the footage had to live up to, you know, this really gritty, you know, gorgeous film footage that had been around for 15 years, and now we were going to the newest digital camera on the market and had to match that same look. So, you know, on a normal day-to-day job, what I'm doing, I suppose first and foremost is, yeah, I'm backing up footage. You know, it's a camera department position, so if I'm not doing it, there'll be a digital loader who's handling it, you know, just downloading footage onto my system. But most of the time I end up handling it. You just... because I'm used to doing it, and I have the hardware to handle that while still simultaneously doing color correction. And then once footage is backed up and has been confirmed, you know, 12 ways from Sunday, we're doing color correction on the footage with the DP or with the gaffer, or, you know, as time goes on and a relationship builds, they'll have me color correct it because we all know the look of the show. And it's a creative color correction. It's not painting the camera as, you know, if we go back a couple years to the F900 when it's taken out the green spike of certain lights or making sure that the cameras match exactly and there's not going to be a differentiation there. Well, you know, obviously we're shooting raw, so if there is a slight variation in the hardware between the cameras, the color changes that we do in post are exactly the same as the ones that we could do in the camera. So matching the cameras is essentially irrelevant because they're capturing the same information no matter what. So it becomes color correcting for the look of the show more than for the technical side of the show. And that's just, it's really nice because, you know, half of the equation with the camera is the color correction, is developing the footage. It's how you want it to look. So much of film is you know, created in the DI these days. So much of the look of a film is created in the DI. That kind of having that access on set is great. You know, so sometimes it might mean lighting a scene a little more flat or a little brighter than perhaps the DP has in their mind, knowing that 5 minutes later, an hour later, whenever they come over to take a look at the DIT equipment, they can say, oh, yeah, brilliant. That's the dark, contrasty, nice look I was going for. We just, you know, you capture all the ones and zeros on the day, and then you make it look pretty a couple minutes later.
What are you using on set to get the look?
These days, you know, so in this season of Southland, for example, I'm using Gamma Intensity's 3CP software, which I've been really impressed with because it enables color correction in a way that is exact. And I'll give you the opposite end to kind of explain myself. A lot of people kind of use two approaches when they're doing on-set color correction at the Red, and I use that term very lightly. Most of the time it's on a laptop, so we're obviously very limited by the hardware available to us, and sometimes there's 6-bit screens, 8-bit screens. I mean, you're really not talking about a lot of information. And if somebody pulls up Red Alert, for example, you know, and they're affecting RSX files with the footage, you're doing it on a monitor that isn't quite calibrated. You only have one scope available to you, a histogram, and it's very easy to accidentally clip or accidentally crush information. And you can get a look that looks pretty good, of course, but you don't have the kind of fine control and accuracy with what you're doing. Like I said, you can get close, but you never know exactly where you are. And if the workflow is just to take those RSX files and then bake that look into the footage into, say, ProRes file, and then they never, ever see the raw files again all the way through post, say, on a commercial. Well, you know, if you bugger up those the RSX files on the day, or if, you know, maybe the DIT wasn't shielding his screen properly and a light's bounced off the screen, well, now you're doomed because they're going to have to retransfer all the footage without that look and then do another layer of color correction afterwards bring the look back in. So it ends up costing a lot of money, and it's a lack of accuracy. And a similar thing can happen with another workflow which I've seen done, which is where you open footage in Red Cine and you, you know, you make it look how you want, and then you export a TIFF, and then you have a colorist that night match it, you know, in a base light or in a DaVinci or whatever he's going to be doing his work in. And that's better because ultimately the color correction is happening on a more appropriate piece of equipment in a more appropriate environment. But, you know, that's no better than when a DP takes a still with their digital camera and then emails it to the colorist. You know, you're going to get close, but you're still kind of using really broad strokes to paint it. I want this contrasty. I want this a little warm. I want this a little cool. You don't get to really get into the nitty-gritty. So with 3CP, I've been able to, you know, I can output to a nice calibrated HDSDI monitor. If I so choose, I could use hardware scopes. I personally don't. It has, you know, enough software scopes to get me where I want to be. I'm not super reliant on them because my approach is I'm not going to complain about having, you know, 12 IRE on somebody's face if it looks brilliant. I would much rather make a pretty picture than a technically right picture. So it lets me get it on a good monitor, and it lets me save one of a million different lookup table. So depending on what the post house is doing, I can send them, you know, the ASC CDL, or I can send them something for a base light, or I can send them something for a luster, you know, any number of lookup tables. And now that all those various DI suites can interface with RED footage, well, it's just dumping that lookup table on top of the raw footage. So they can see exactly what I did on the day, but it's not permanent, and then it can be modified appropriately. And that's the strength of the kind of on-set workflows that I usually end up with. Is I, you know, as a DIT on set, I'm spending 80% of my time standing next to the DP discussing things. Or it'll be myself, the gaffer, and the DP, and a camera operator. And between those four, we're essentially shooting the show. So when I'm away from that and I'm doing color correction, I mean, I can't color correct every single shot that we do in a day. I could, but it would, you know, quality would suffer, and so would my time on set. And in, you know, in the traditional DIT sense, that's sort of the DIT's duty. But I found on RED shows, it's a much more creative position, and so much can be done through talking rather than turning a trackball. That you know, that it's a more valuable position on set. So we create a couple looks for every scene, and then pass those lookup tables along with the footage and a series of reference charts that, not that we shoot, but reference information that shows what settings I changed to post. And then when they're sitting in the base light for Southland's example, they can pull and up my lookup table, drop it directly onto the footage. But you know, if I was in a slightly rough situation, maybe a light was hitting my monitor, maybe my eyes were a little off and I made it look a little green, but it has no business being green, they're able to fix that. They're able to fine-tune the things that I would be wasting time and losing my sanity doing on the day.
Take me through the gear you've got.
As far as gear, I've got a couple of Mac Pros, essentially maxed out systems, with more input-output cards than you can imagine. I've got a pretty hefty RAID on my cart. I think right now it's 30 terabytes. That sounds about right. And that's enough to store, you know, a couple seasons TV or a couple features on there. So footage always gets backed up there and it stays there as long as it needs to stay there. I also have, you know, LTO4 tape backup drives on my cart as well. And then a bunch of input-output for the system. So, for example, reading RED 16-gigabyte cards, I've had some custom SAS-based card readers put together where I can actually download with checksums an entire RED 16-gig card in about 2 minutes. And I can do multiple simultaneously. So inside of 4 minutes, I can back up four or five cards.
Right. Is that a one-off unit or...?
Yes. A very similar unit could be built fairly inexpensively. It's you know, there are parts out there that could all be assembled. It'd be from about four or five different manufacturers, and it would be, you know, one would have to know what they were doing to put it together, but it's by no means not something that only I have access to. It's something that that if somebody really were serious about being a DIT or a digital loader and they were going to build their system, they could do it. And I've actually been in talks with a couple of companies now, as far as equipment is concerned, who are thinking about building their own, and I'm willing to bet it's going to become pretty popular. But, you know, I've got that, and I've got a couple of FireWire cards and a couple SATA cards and a couple FAST cards just for the sake of being able to move data through this machine quickly. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm out before the camera assistants are. I mean, it's, you know, DITs who are spending half hour, an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours after wrap, you know, something's gone wrong. Like, if it takes more than 15 minutes after wrap, it perhaps should have been a little better planning. As far as control surfaces are concerned, I don't have any yet, because right now 3CP doesn't interface with any control surfaces. I've been talking with the guys over there. They're really receptive to feedback, and they do have plans to interface with all of the usual suspects as far as interfaces concerned, the tangent panels and so on. So it wouldn't surprise me if in the next couple of months we see that, because, you know, I love the keyboard and mouse to death, but when I'm dealing with color, I love nothing more than actually having a proper surface in front of me. So
you're just doing all of your grading by mouse or via old school trackball, I guess?
Yeah, it's actually, I have the little Apple Mighty Mouse with that little miniature trackball in the middle, and then I can roll up and down with that to adjust various settings. It's kind of, you know, you get used to it very quickly. I do a lot of the basic corrections that we're doing with curves, and that, you know, that just comes from being an old school Photoshop guy. Not necessarily, I mean, that's not the right way or the wrong way to do it, and I'm sure I just caused a lot of colorists out there to shudder, but it works for the sort of quick, you know, show me the look in 10 seconds color correction that needs to happen sometimes.
Wrapping up on the workflow, knowing when to swap stuff over and then to do your backups, do it just at lunchtime or at the end of every scene, what's that workflow like?
All right, well, in a perfect world, I always try and get productions to use 16 gig cards. And that's just because you can put, you know, you can roll 120 frames on them. They don't have any limitations like the 8 gigs do. They behave like a 1,000-foot mag. It takes 3 seconds to reload. And it keeps that workflow going. So at the most, at the worst, on a two-camera show, the most I'm ever going to have backed up at any given time is 2 full cards. You know, the most I'm ever going to be in trouble with is 2 full cards. They can never say, like, no, don't reload now. We're just going to roll on this. We need it. The sun's setting, whatever. And since reloading those cards is so fast, it's not like the red drives where you have to let it format for 45 seconds or so. You can keep things moving. And
yeah,
most of the guys that I work with are all film guys and have been forever. So the idea of reloading every 1,000 feet is just what they're used to.
Yeah, it makes sense.
So I actually personally don't like to use red drives because they're just 2 laptop hard drives in a little metal case, and it's a hand grenade. I can just see that thing eating footage.
Yeah.
But if that's the situation, I'm going to be reloading every, 10% or 15% on one of those. But I'm never going to do it at a time where it's interrupting somebody or causing a problem. So it's not like in the middle of the scene, I'm going to run into the room and say, oh, hold on, guys, we need to reload, and now I'm going to hold everybody up for a minute. It'll be something that happens in between setups, or maybe when the dolly's getting pushed, over across the room, or maybe when the camera assistants are swapping from a prime to a zoom or something, I can do it then. I try and hide it in a time when it's not going to cost anybody anything, when nobody's trying to look through the lens.
So then how are you monitoring when to swap it over then? I mean, there is loaders on set as well, I guess.
So in the case of the 16 gig cards, the camera assistants, over the weeks and months of a show, they know the camera well enough. They can handle reloading on their own. They don't need me to come up and kind of hold their hands through the process. So they've got a little Pelican case with a couple of compact flash cards in their pocket. And we have a system so that when they reload the camera, obviously, we make sure that shot cards get labeled and sealed appropriately so there's no way they could go back into the camera. And we have a workflow so that any time, if the camera ever warns you, there's footage on this magazine, are you sure you want to format it, that everything stops and we figure out where the problem is. So we've got enough, warning signs in place that we can never accidentally delete a card.
Yeah, so essentially you are there is a first AC and there's a second AC. That essentially they're the ones keeping an eye on the footage, just like the old days.
Bingo. Yeah, we try and keep it as much like a film set as possible. You've got 2 first assistants, 2 second assistants, and then a utility who essentially functions as the loader, grabbing cases and grabbing coffee and filling out time cards and doing all those wonderful things that a loader does for us, minus the actual loading.
But he's doing slates and he's assisting with lens changes and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. From the union perspective, the local 600, the camera union in the United States, has jurisdiction over backing up, digital files, digital footage as it relates to a camera like the Red or the HVX or any number of 100 cameras that will come out over the next couple of years. So if you look back at this same on-set relationship in a year, what it's going to be is it'll be a loader, a digital loader, which will be on the same roster and the same classification as a film loader, an entry-level position, and they'll have been trained by the union or by any number of other outlets to know how to back up data. That'll be what it looks like in a year. But as of today, I usually end up doing the backing up of data on my own.
Moving back to ER, obviously there was a lot of buzz at the time of ER switching to Red for the last few episodes, which I guess in my mind seemed a little bit odd. What triggered that change for them?
I've been asked that question before, and I there's so many different answers. The producers of ER had done a pilot, which at the time was called Police and then LAPD, which eventually became Southland, which is now going into its second season. And we shot that pilot on Red. So the guys had experience with Red, and they liked the camera, and they liked kind of the concept, the idea of shooting digitally, but shooting it in a way that doesn't require all this overhead, which interestingly enough, it ends up requiring just about the same amount of overhead, but it just feels like it's kind of faster and more cutting edge. So there was a bit of that. One of the directors of the show, one of the producers, wanted to shoot his last episode on Red. And when they started budgeting it out and figuring it out, they said, oh, well, why don't we just shoot the last 4 episodes on Red, because that's what they had left at the time. And after that, they actually picked up 3 more episodes in total. So the final 7 episodes were shot on Red. It also was, there's an interesting perspective when you've been on a show for 15 years with people, and it's more of a family than you would ever see built on a feature or on a commercial. And here were these camera assistants and the sound department and all these people who've been on there for over a decade, who've been working with the same Panavision package forever, and they had such a set routine that actually mixing it up for them, giving them the newest, scariest camera on the market, And making that change, it did elevate some of those assistants. It's not only the guys who were on ER forever, but those guys who handled the Red. They got this. They know this. So they're kind of being released into the wild, the right knowledge and the right experience to just pick up right where they left off.
Because obviously I've always seen ER as like a really fast-paced shoot, you know, covering pages and pages of dialogue in each scene.
Oh, yeah. 7 to 9 pages a day, no problem.
No offense to Red, but I'm amazed that it fitted in with that way of working.
It's actually really interesting. It's such a well-oiled machine that, you know, they were going to be shooting 6 to 10 pages a day, no matter what. That's no problem. Getting that done in 12 hours wasn't even stressful. As far as the camera was concerned, really the camera assistants, once they learn the basics of the camera, which they picked up during the prep, and they really got it quite quickly. It's almost exactly the same stuff for them. Interestingly enough, and this was from the two camera assistants, Toby and Richie, who said that of all the changes that we made going from, you know, Panavision to Red, the thing that boned them the most, the thing that they really had to change, was just going from Panavision gear to Arri gear. You know, instead of swapping lenses and just being so used to this Panavision system that kind of where there's a part for everything and everything has a part, where the Arri system is much more, and don't take this the wrong way, but it's much more like an Erector set. There are 1,000 pieces, and all of them can do something different. And that was the pain for them. It's, oh, we need these rods from here, we need this follow focus, and we need this map box, because this one works with this, but doesn't work with that lens, and now we need this. That was the pain for them.
Yeah, because that's where Panavision has really nailed it. You don't even take the follow focus off the camera, you know?
Bingo, exactly. I mean, interestingly enough, we actually ended up adding a camera to ER. They had 2 film bodies before. When we switched over to Red, we had 3. We had a studio camera, we had a Steadicam camera, and then we had a handheld camera. It just made us switching between cameras much, much faster. There was no guessing, no trying to find parts. And it worked really well. We had really balanced camera rig. Everything kind of was in its place. We were using the IDX HD transmitters and Camwave. We actually had a sound converter and a modulus mounted on the Video Village, so everybody who had their standard def monitors around the set, you know, the gaffer had one of the costume designers had one. Everybody still got their monitors, and nothing really changed for anybody outside of the camera department.
So you're working with someone who I consider an absolute god, Jim Muro, who I've followed his career largely through his Steadicam and ACAM work with Jim Cameron, Abyss, Titanic, True Lies.
Absolutely.
A ton of utterly amazing work. With all of that, a career forged in pain, he must be an amazing DP.
Oh my God, it's unbelievable. Yeah, he's wonderful to work with.
And he's standing right there.
More or less. You know, it's really interesting if you look at the look of the show. It's very, very camera-oriented, the way the Southline books. So, you know, we'll do a lot of natural light situations, and we'll do some very lit situations. But we'll still try and get it to look very guerrilla and very real. But the camera work is so dynamic, and the shots are so interesting. I mean, if you actually sit back and watch the show and just try and understand some of the camera moves that we pull off, you know, in 4 locations a day, it's really something to see. You know, we're doing a whole lot of very special rigs where we're passing a camera off through a window, or, you know, putting the accessories separate from the body in a bag so we can have something as light as possible. Or there's a whole lot of iris racks, and a whole lot of, you know, even on a Steadicam, we're grabbing the lens and racking the iris. And it's very, it looks very rough at first, but it's interesting. It's so dynamic and so interesting and so engaging to watch that it kind of brings the show to life. That kind of energy and that kind of, you know, that new perspective brought to the way that a show is shot is wonderful.
So if you were going to outline the gotchas for the job, the kind of 10 commandments of DIT, what would they be?
You know, it's really interesting. If you look at, and it's not really a DIT position, but if you look at the very basic digital loader position on steroids, we're talking about taking files on one form of digital media and moving them to another. We're taking stuff on a hard drive and moving it to another hard drive. Or it seems very simple. And the Red itself is a very simple camera when it's behaving properly. It's, you know, the menus aren't that complicated as long as you know the right options and you know what settings to have. It seems like it's all well and good. And as far as the workflow is concerned, many people look at it as an HDX on steroids, or they see what they can do on a laptop, and they go, God, well, this is it. All we need is, you know, a laptop, and we're in business, and we can bypass all of these big difficulties. We can bypass the monitors and the tent and the DIT and all that. And people, unfortunately, get kind of wrapped up in that. And that can be tricky. because while it is very simple when it's all going according to plan, it never goes according to plan. There's always going to be glitches, and that's not glitches with the camera and whatnot. Well, obviously that does happen. Things never go quite right. There's always going to be that situation when somebody gets a mag mixed up with another mag, or that copy, for whatever reason, didn't copy properly, and there's bad or corrupt data in there, or, God, which card is this? Is this an empty card? Is this a full card? Which pile was this in? And what happens if, you know, you get unplugged in the middle of the day? Are you doomed? There's so many little problems that can go wrong. What happens if the camera's overheating? What happens if it's crashing? And also so many little points that people can learn that can make things go either smoothly or, you know, not smoothly. It'll still get done, but it's not going to be quite right. And that's where people can get into trouble. They sort of underestimate the responsibilities of the position, and they underestimate the amount of preparation and the amount of knowledge that is really required. I sometimes jokingly call it a fireman position on set, where if I'm having an easy day on a job and we're, let's say it's commercial, we're not doing a whole lot of color correction, I'm backing up the footage and I'm talking with the DP all day, seems great. Oh, it seems like I just got paid to stand around.
Yeah.
And somebody can look at that and they go, well, you know, I know how to drag and drop a file, or I could figure out how to use an application like R3D Data Manager or ShotPut. You know, it's a couple buttons. That's great. You know, my kid's super smart. Maybe I can bring him in, or we can give it to a PA. And then it hits the fan. And then you're missing a shot, or then you're having a hard drive fail, or then you've got a corruption of some kind, or maybe the camera started crashing, or this accessory stopped working. You know, and then suddenly you kick into overdrive, and it goes from, you know, trying to answer a question or trying to look busy to you've got 100 or 200 people literally staring at you, and you're spending $1,000 a minute. And if that thing isn't running, if, you know, if we're not rolling in 2 minutes, the sun sets, or, you know, we need to go, or we lose the location or whatnot, that's when it counts. So I think people can approach the position both as DITs and as people hiring DITs from the perspective that it is very simple, or that it is very trivial, that it is perhaps an entry-level position. I've seen that happen a lot. And it really isn't. I mean, the amount of knowledge and preparation and skill that somebody has to have to really be able to handle everything properly, get it all done, and to answer every question, and to know what could happen in any situation, and to be able to recognize bugs before they happened and solve them before anybody notices them. And that's what makes the difference. And that's when somebody can really shine. And also just to be able to speak English. You know, it's very easy to talk about, you know, chroma subsampling and debayering patterns, but that doesn't mean anything to the DP who's been shooting film for 50 years. You gotta be a member of the camera department. You gotta know where to stand. You gotta know who to talk to, who not to talk to, when to shut up, when to pipe up, and when to blow the whistle, when it's clipping, when there's too much light, when there's not enough light. I mean, it is a lot of politics as well. And it's people skills, and it's so many little things that I couldn't dare bring into, one little paragraph on how to describe it. But yeah, it's underestimating it can be a big issue.
Sounds simplistic, but you've really opened my eyes. Actually, when you think about it, it's a really fantastic position, because you're not just, you're on set dealing with the camera guys, but you're also one-on-one with director and DP and right through to grader, a real creative input.
That's what attracted me to the position, and that's, you know, I've spent the last 3 years trying my hardest to craft the position into that, because I don't want to drag and drop files all day. That's not fun to me. But what's fun to me is when I'm standing next to a brilliant DP, or standing with a gaffer and having these conversations and having this creative input in the show. That's what makes it worth it to me, and that's what I think makes the position both so important and so nice. You know, when the position is respected, and when the information that the DIT can bring to the table really does improve things, it's wonderful.
Fantastic. Thanks, Brooke. Thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it. I know you're busy and you're on set. And
No problem.
How can people find you or find out more?
Head to my website. It's brookwillard.com. There's absolutely nothing of interest up there. Or, you know, I'm always posting on Red User. I'm a moderator there, and I'm doing my best to I don't know, spread the knowledge, to try and learn as much as I can and to answer as many questions as I can. So,
yeah, good luck with the show, and yeah, we'll catch up on the other side.
All right, you got it.
Well, thanks for that, Jace. I really enjoyed that. And next time on the show, you actually have Sue Gibson, haven't you, from the British Society of Cinematographers?
Yes. Sue Gibson is the president of the British Society of Cinematographers, and they have done an incredibly in-depth evaluation. I mean, this is what – obviously, since this evaluation came out, everyone's been going, oh, what camera won? What camera won? Essentially, they were comparing film stocks and everything from the Canon 5D up 35mm anamorphic, Super 16, digital, red – you name it, and putting all these cameras together really as a sort of a database and as a kind of a reference guide for producers and DPs wanting to choose, you know, so you can choose the right format. It was never designed to be, you know, this competition to see, you know, which one won.
They kind of lame the idea that, because I mean, really, it's, you know, let's have a shootout to see which pencil is the best, you know, for drawing.
I love shootouts. It's fabulous.
Do you?
But
I think there's some benefit in comparing things. I just don't think, as you say, you want to go for the winner is.
Yeah, exactly right. So, I mean, and it's a very, very interesting when you look at the how they, the process of actually doing it is quite amazing. If you look at the fact they had to, obviously catch up with this next week, but if you imagine they have to shoot like 9 or 12 cameras, or if you have to do exteriors, you can't shoot one, especially in England where the light, you know, it's up, the light's up and down like a bride's nightie. You've got to have every, they have basically, but they built a dolly rig to mount like 11 or 13 cameras or whatever it was, all on, so they could all shoot simultaneously. There's a fantastic shot of it, and I'll put that in the show notes for next week, of all of these cameras all bolted and rigged onto one dolly to do an exterior shot all at the same time. So it's just the exterior shots alone is a mammoth effort, and obviously then they've done interiors, shadows, highlights, and you know, and the, just the mammoth post of comparing all those formats where you've got film and you've got digital, and you know, the workflow was it is a really, really mammoth effort. So Sue goes into in depth into that, and that is for next week's show. Now
I have some late breaking news.
Okay.
Is that all right? Sorry, can I interrupt you? Because I know you have a really, really cool piece of kit coming up.
Yes.
But as we have been talking, the alpha has been released on Red User of the Red Cine X, which is the next version of Red Cine, the one that we saw the video of.
Right. Oh, okay.
So as we've been speaking, that's been released. So I can't actually give you a review of it or anything.
I think I have a Red following our Twitters.
Sorry?
So that's on red.com/support?
I don't know. I just have been sent it. So and I've been told it was released as we were speaking.
Okay.
It's the actual Red Cine X.
Red Cine X beta.
So the, well...
No, sorry. Alpha, I'm looking at...
I believe.
That's right. I'm jumping ahead. Okay.
It auto-finds and populates your R3Ds throughout your system on launch.
Okay. Well...
It's very cool.
Obviously, we'll put the details of where we find that. If it can be found, can it be downloaded? We'll put all that in the show notes.
It can be downloaded. And apparently the caching speed and playback is just astonishing with it.
Okay.
Even on like a MacBook Pro unibody.
Wow.
It's just really, really good.
Wow. Okay. Excellent. All right. Well, okay. Yeah, so that was that fantastic demo that we saw.
Exactly. This is literally like real-time grading feedback while it's playing, and waveforms for the audio, and just heaps of cool stuff.
Excellent. All right.
But we will cover that obviously next week when we have a chance to actually do it.
Absolutely. All right. Well, you can all play along at home.
Hey, sorry to interrupt you, but I would really like to discuss this piece of kit you found because I'm kind of stunned by it.
Well, I mean, I've found it. It's been gathering a bit of momentum on Red User, but I sort of originally saw this a while ago and I thought, oh, that looks really weird. And then, you know, there's a few videos on YouTube and a few videos on their site to see how it actually works. And until you actually see how this works, you'd probably go, another handheld rig. But this is really some lateral thinking from the guys at therunningrig.com. Now, essentially, it is a shoulder rig, but if you imagine the fact that at your shoulder there is a pivot, so you can actually, if you're holding two bullhorns or two handles out in front of you, you can then put the camera right on its side, put it on the other side. Essentially, it's like if anyone's ever actually shot out of a helicopter from a Tyler mount, you'll know almost what the feeling of this is, the fact that the camera is free and you can sort of Dutch it as you. And the other cool thing about it is that the camera platform, the platform or the sled that the camera is sitting on, is able to pan. So you can actually have your handles pointing forward, but have the camera looking back over your shoulder, kind of Don Juan style, or have it, or literally be sitting in the passenger seat of a car with your hands pointing right out in front of you as if you were shooting out the windscreen, yet your camera is looking at the driver, and have all handheld control. That's obviously going to do very weird things to your brain, looking backwards and all that sort of stuff, but...
And just to clarify that, we're not talking about you can mount it differently with a, you know, screwdriver before you get into the car. You're talking about it dynamically panning while I'm operating.
Exactly. Now, I'm still yet to work out how you do it. We're imagining it looks fairly mechanical and fairly simplistic. There's no motors and servos going on from what we can see. It's a simple twist of a hand grip, and that is directly linked through a, you know, a sprocketed belt through to the... It's very hard to imagine. You just have to go to the show notes. Or go to runningrig.com, and there's some fantastic videos of how it works. And I will definitely try to get in contact with this guy and have a little bit more, definitely have an interview and find out a little bit more of this thing.
Interview with him shirtless as he is in the demo videos.
There's lots of videos of him running around what looks like gorgeous Greek Mykonos alleyways, filming, following gorgeous girls as you would. This looks extremely...
If I was in Mykonos with this rig, with a red one, I would follow gorgeous girls running over the landscape. Yes.
And it looks interesting. I mean, obviously, if you imagine if you then put the camera mounting back behind you, you'd imagine almost like sort of filming in a mirror that, whoa, tilt down becomes up. And so, yeah, I'd be interested to talk to him about how you get around to this. There's a great shot of it with the red one mounted on it. Looks fantastic. All of the battery and the drive go on the back over your shoulder, so the weight forward isn't so much. You can mount the LCD right down in front of you, in front of the bars.
So it wouldn't turn as the camera does.
Exactly. So theoretically, yeah, the camera will move independently of your LCD. So, yeah.
Which would be great, right? Because you could really, you know, work well having that LCD separately mounted underneath.
Yeah, and the footage looks fantastically smooth. I think why it looks smooth is that there is that slight disconnect. The sort of roll axis, I suppose, is disconnected somewhat from your shoulder to your hands.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Because your hands are sort of free to take out some of the roll or put some of the roll. A lot of the footage, I mean, obviously he's walking with a fairly wide lens, but it does look very, you know, getting halfway to Steadicam smooth. So I think what intrigues me about this is that someone's sort of gone against the norm and thought outside the square a bit of this. So I'm definitely going to find out a little bit more about this. But in the meantime, yeah, look at the link in the show notes and some pictures and... check out the website, the-running-rig.com. Full marks to Constantine, the owner and inventor of the running rig, and we'll definitely be trying to track you down, my son.
This is one of the things that I really love when you get a filmmaker that uses, you know, necessity as the mother of invention and comes up with just a really innovative thing that you go, oh my God, that is just brilliant.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's too expensive for what it is. I think
it looks beautifully made. $2,500, it looks like. You can pre-order. I'm yet to find out from him what the situation is with delivery dates and, you know, how far he is into his, you know, pre-orders, when you would actually see one if you ordered it. Because there is a web store there. You can order it, and you can order accessories, different sort of brackets and V-mounts for your batteries at the back. So you can literally have everything all pre-wired and snap it all in. So, yeah, it looks... And I actually think it's really affordable. When you look at it, it's a very beautifully machined and done piece of kit. It all looks like carbon rails and milled aluminium. So, yummy.
Yes, I must admit, I've just bought a Red Rock Micro.
Have you?
Yeah, right. Stubling. The stew version of it, yeah.
Excellent,
so
okay.
I'm just in the process of buying it, I should say.
One more 5D shoot for me, and I'm going to actually go the other way, and no offence, Stu, but go for the Sakuto, what looks like the little Sakuto, really rapid fire.
To hold your iPhone? Sorry, go
not
on.
Not to hold my iPhone. No, if I have to do another 5D shoot, I'm not going to struggle on with something else. I'm definitely going to lash out on that. If I can't quite make a decision to lash out on the on the camera, I'll definitely make a decision to lash out on something to hold it up off the ground.
Well, thank you so much for your time listening to us this week. And, Jace, thank you for coming in. Thanks, Jace, you're on the Twitters as Wingrove.
I am, and my website, jasonwingrove.com. And also co-host with Mike with another podcast, the VFX Show, vfxshow.com, where we talk about Jurassic completely Disney. Unrelated
visual effects work.
Visual effects work.
I also want to thank Matt Graham, who's going to be doing the editing for this show,
and also
Jason Diamond, who's been researching and posting information to me as I speak to make me sound much more clever than I actually am. Thank you, Jason. We appreciate that. And thank you guys for supporting the show. It's been really terrific. We've had umpteen people come up to us as we've been traveling around saying how much they enjoy the show. We clearly love doing it, and we love talking to you guys, so keep those comments coming. And
yep.
No comment is too small. Just feel free to email us.
Absolutely.
Or just direct message us, or just hit us on the Twitters.
To Twitter or red@fxguide.com. Now, when we say FX Guide, we say that all the time, but I actually think about it as the letter F, the letter X, guide.com.
Yeah, like TV Guide, only with FX.
Like TV Guide, but better.
Yeah, for effects. Yeah, that's how we started. And yes, an FX Guide, of course, is it's been going now for 10 years, FX Guide.
Well done.
So, yes, we're very proud of it.
Over 10 years, or are you about to have a 10-year party?
1999 we formed.
Right.
John Montgomery, Jeff Hughes and myself.
So and a 10-year party is imminent, or...
We had a big 10-year party at NAB, and I couldn't go. So it was the largest party we've ever thrown. It was a cracker, and I wasn't able to attend, but that's fine.
Excellent.
And you'll find some other cool stuff over at FX Guide. In fact, we now have FX Guide TV in Spanish, and we also have stuff like, for example, District 9, detailed discussion on that at the moment. And we're about to have a really – when I bring this up, we're about to have this really interesting discussion over at FX Guide with the – a senior colorist of Lord of the Rings and the last four Harry Potter films, Peter Doyle. And we get into a really detailed discussion on stocks, on print stocks, on the process of color grading a major feature film at a proper serious high-end technical level. It is not really lightweight listening, and I loved it. Just enjoyed talking to him so much.
Because rat-holing, because we can do that at the end here. You can go if you like or stay and listen. But when you did the VFX show on Half-Blood Prince, mm-hmm. you talked a lot about the look and the mm-hmm. grade and everything. I said, yeah, okay, fine. And then I just saw it a couple of days ago and totally agree. Outstanding look. It just looked – I think it's the most beautiful looking Harry Potter since, and the grade and everything. It's just
– it's really
it's
interesting.
Astonishing looking film.
And I guess it's sort of related
film.
To a Red Center audience, but – he tried to develop a new kind of filmic look that was filmic but not reliant on the problems of film, which are to say film grain. Like, it's easy to make something look filmic if you make it look cinematic and grainy and, you know, put in weave and float and just looks like film.
Yeah.
He was actually trying to define a more cinematic look that was cinematic as opposed to the realism of, say, District 9, but not relying on the faults of film to do it. Does that make sense? And
right.
Yeah, so there's like certain halation kind of aspects to it that we get into. And his discussion about being able to do that on the scale that they did for Harry Potter, because a lot of prints are being struck, so they had to be able to, you know, they couldn't do, for example, as you might want to do, is premium stock, because you just can't make that many release prints premium stock. You've got to make them around the world. And he's also looking at the digital version of the print and how that's going to show up both for digital production.
I can't wait for the digital prints to start to roll out, because, you know, down here in the Antipodes, it's also the arse end of the world when it comes to cinema prints. I don't know. I don't know what we get sent here, but, you know, when I go to the movies, and I don't, you know, go to some backwater cinema, it just looks shocking. You know, I'm sick of seeing, you know, center softness and flickering bulbs and, you know, just sort of almost look like it's all been shot through a shift lens. Yeah, so bring on and dusty prints and real jumps and...
Shame you can't join us on Sunday for Up.
I know. I can't.
The Visual Effects Society in Sydney is having a special screening of Up, and we want to thank...
Because it's... only just coming out here in Australia, the arse end of the world. I'm dying to see it. No, hopefully going to see it on...
sponsoring that, and also Pixar is being very generous.
I shall be seeing it on Saturday in two dimensions.
Is it out on Saturday? I thought it came out the following week.
I thought it came out on... Did it not come out today?
Oh, well, there you go.
Maybe not. I could be wrong. I could be
devastatingly wrong. It's
I think actually the science of getting a really good look in the cinema just doubles when you, of course, have stereoscopic. And I was lucky enough to see up in the US. It was a good projection where I saw it there. And I'm looking forward to this because it'll be a projection that will be obviously first run or virtually first run of the print because
right.
It's only just been done. And I think it's – well, actually – I say that. It's, presumably, it's going to be a digital projection. Now I come to think about
right,
it.
Right, in so, town. Yeah, it would have to be, surely.
So, yes.
Bruno Delbonnel is the guy who shot... and I'm looking at Half-Blood Prince.
And I hate to break it to you, dude, but the release date I'm seeing for this film is like the 17th.
Okay.
And I would be seeing this on the 6th.
Okay, well, I'll be seeing
like
it.
2 weeks earlier. I did invite you.
You did, and I'm sorry I couldn't do it. Bruno Delbonnel actually shot... Fabulous Destiny of Amelie, which I deeply, deeply admire. So
there's a new
no wonder I love it. It's fabulous.
There's a new Amelie coming.
So no wonder I like the look of it. That's brilliant. So yes, it was a fabulous. And your your conversation on VFX VFX show was very interesting. As will be your your chat on FX Guide.
Excellent. Well, look, we've run a little over, but there you go.
There you go.
If you didn't want to hang around for this secondary part of the show, you didn't have to. until next time, I'm Mike Simmel.
I'm Jason Wingrove. Thanks for listening, guys.
See ya.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2009, FX Guide, LLC.